Parsha Vayeshev is filled with so many great things, and of course, it always comes around Hanukkah.
There's
Yosef's dreams. There's Mechirat Yosef and the famous Rashbam there. There's of course Yosef and Mrs. Potiphar, Yosef and Tzar Mashkin, which we did last year. There's one parsha that's almost always ignored, and that is Yehuda and Tamar. So instead of looking at it atomistically and looking at the details in the story, I want to ask a larger question. What's the story here for at all? Who cares? What do we need it for? Now think about it. If it's there to establish a lineage, which would be part of the argument, Rashi says here that Hachim Oskim B'mechirato Shel Yosef Av Mitabel Yosef, everybody's doing their own thing. V'Kodesh Baruch Hu Borei Morosh HaMashiach. God is preparing the way for Mashiach. And that is the birth of Peretz, who's going to be ultimately the ancestor of David, etc. But for that, you don't need this story. For that, all you need is the list that we're going to get anyways in Parsha V'Yigash that tells us, B'nei Yehuda, Erev Yonan V'Sheilah, and Erev and Onan died, and then there's Peretz and Zerach and Sheilah and Mishpachat HaPartzi, Chatzon V'Chamul. Good, take it from there. We don't need this whole story for that. So you might argue that this story is necessary in order to kind of set the tone for tshuva. Right? Tshuva. Yehuda is the great Baal tshuva, and the Midrash picks up on this. Matter of fact, the Midrash even says that at the very end of the Torah, we dealt with this, in Simchas Torah, we talked about the brachot, v'zot liYehuda. Yechi Ruven v'alyamot, v'zot liYehuda. What's the connection between Ruven and Yehuda? Yehuda was the one who inspired Ruven to do tshuva for his actions with Bilhah, whatever they may be. We'll get back to that. And therefore, because Yehuda did tshuva famously in this piece. What's his tshuva? Two words. Tzadka mimeni. Unclear really where the tshuva is there. In other words, he was, quote unquote, man enough not to cover it up. So let's go over the story, make sure we're clear on the basics. And then I'd like to suggest that this story is really there for a very different reason. It's a critical story, but it's a critical story with an eye towards something very different in the larger scope of Bereshit and of Yaakov's family. The story, writ large, the quick version of it, is that Yehuda separates from his brothers, Vayered Yehuda Meitachav, and he befriends a fellow from Adulam. Now, our Tanakh geography, for most people, Tanakh geography is a very challenging thing. And so what we do is we do what we do with most challenging things, we ignore it. Right? And then we're, if we don't pay much attention to where things are at. But it's critical to note where Adulam is. Adulam is in the Shfelah. In other words, Yehuda, like all the brothers, lives in Hebron, and Yehuda goes west, down into the Shfelah, into the area which is, if you will, somewhere between Modi'in and Rehovot, in that area. That's where Adulam is. It's a famous place in the stories of David. Yehuda goes there is a critical piece of the puzzle because later on in Jewish history, that's the middle of Eretz Yehuda. It means the operating in the land that's ultimately going to become his. That may itself be something. But Yehuda meets a fellow who is from Adulam named Chira. Now, I don't care about this guy Chira, I think, because I'm never going to hear his name again, except in this story. So I'm wondering, why am I told his name? And he then meets a fellow named Shua, which is not short for Yehoshua, it's a Canaanite name. And Shua is a Kanani. I'm familiar with the Onklus, who says Socher, and some of the Rishonim who say that. Others disagree and say he's really a Kanani. We're actually going to talk about that also. But he has a daughter, no name. Yehuda marries the daughter. Yehuda has three sons. Fred McMurray. Right? An heir, Onan and Shelah, parenthetically about the names. What does Er mean? Ayin Resh. Er means childless. Right? What's Karet? Ariri. What's Onan? Mourning. And what's Shelah mean? No, without an Aleph. Shelah is illusion. Al Tashleoti. Don't fool me. Don't deceive me. What kind of names are these? Who is going to give their kids names, Er, Onan, and Shelah? It's strange. So there is a strain of thinking, which I think is very well supported, which is echoed in the mirror story of Tamar and Yehuda, which is, of course, the story of Ruth and Boaz, etc. And That is that these names are not real names. That they had Chaim Yankel and Moshe Pippik, whatever the names were, and after the story is told, because we're getting this from Moshe Rabbeinu, not from Yehuda, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him to put other names in that reflect what actually happens in the story. Because what actually happens? Er grows up, and Yehuda finds him a wife, a girl named Tamar, who, from all the implications, is a Canaanite girl. We have no information about what she looks like or anything else. We get some information later on about her level of initiative and brazenness. But more than that, we don't know. Er marries Tamar, and God kills Er, and there's no kids. Why? The text doesn't tell us. Chazal linked two things together, but what does Yehuda say to Onan? Bo yabem, eshtachicha, yavdu yibum. And a very famous Ramban here, who says that Yibum was not initiated by the Torah, it's something that always existed as a mitzvah for any of the males in the family to take care of a childless widow, and that the Torah limited it to the brother, and which is why things play out the way they do. So, Onan refuses to fulfill the mitzvah properly, and the English word onanism actually comes from this story, as a result, God kills him. It says, Vayamet Gamoto.
Do we know why Onan refuses?
No. Chazal tell us because she was beautiful and he didn't want to wreck her beauty by having her get pregnant. Right? But the text says he knew that the kid wouldn't be his. He would have a kid and the kid would be called his dead brother's kid, an act of great selfishness. Onan is presented as an extremely self-centered person. No interest in his brother's name, right? And certainly no care for this girl, and God kills him. Now the Vayamet Gamoto, Chazal then say, aha, it must be that Er was killed for the same reason, and that Er also was engaged in coitus interruptus, and there Chazal say the reason is, because she's a very beautiful girl, he didn't want to wreck that by impregnating her, going back to the story of Lamech and Adan Silah. What happens? He then says, wait till Shelah grows up. Now, to listen to the names again. Er, childless. Onan, mourning. It's exactly what's happening in their lives. And now we have Shelah. What does Yehuda say to Tamar? I'm just paraphrasing the story quickly. He says, you go back to your parents' home, Shvi Almana Beit Avich, sit as a widow, and wait until Shelah grows up. He's not of age yet. But of course, what is Yehuda saying to himself? The text tells us, I'm never going to let her get near him. Which means he is an illusion. So his name exactly fits who he is. Which seems to indicate that those weren't the names given, but those are the names that we then apply to them, just like Machlon and Kilion, which are names that nobody would give their kid, sickness and destruction, but the names that are applied after the story.
Do you think that was a custom in that day also to do this?
To do what?
Idea that wait for the next son?
Well, he's too young.
No, I'm saying the idea of going back to their father's house and waiting.
As opposed to what?
This wasn't the Jewish custom. This was just
the Near Eastern customs. As opposed to what? What's the option?
She's free.
Oh, no. That was the norm of Yibum, is that you're tied to the family, which is why the next thing happens. So what?
How often would they... I mean, this is such an unusual case. The first two die.
I'm sure it's not the first time.
It probably was.
We don't know. We don't have any other record. We don't have the data. Maybe it was a local custom in this particular region. Right? So she goes back, she realizes it ain't going to happen, and here's where she makes the move. Now, you could read her move, if you want, very selfishly. We don't read it that way, generally, but you could read it very selfishly as saying, look, I can't marry anybody else. I'm stuck. I'm essentially an aguna. So, and I want to have a family, or I want to be with a man, or I want to, you know, not be alone. And so, therefore, I'm going to insinuate myself into this family that is really shunning me, but not freeing me. And maybe there's no vehicle of freedom. There's no chalitza. So maybe no way to free her. So what happens? She learns later on that Yehuda's wife dies. Now, you know, in teach the story, that's why this story is usually skipped, because there's so many things about it that are, I've skipped, I think, in day school, so many things about it that you just have to turn everybody into a fruit salesman, if you recall the Rahab thing, right? You just can't teach it straight up, because there's too many things. What are you talking about? How could anybody do such a thing? And it comes to this. Yehuda's wife dies, so Yehuda's looking for some company, the way the text presents it. And Tamar hears that he's looking for some company, so she goes and finds herself at some crossroads. You got Robert Johnson playing in the background. And Yehuda finds her, and she dresses up in a way that he doesn't recognize her. Whatever that may mean. that he didn't know what she looked like at all, like the Gemara Megillah says, or whether she really put on some sort of an outfit, or it was dark. What? From the veil, but she was dark. He didn't know. In any case, he negotiates with her. I want to have relations with you. What do the negotiations come down to? That you know, he's going to send thing, and he leaves a pledge. The pledge is his staff and his seal and his his signet and his staff and his belt. Right, those things that are unique markers, ID marks of his. They have relations, and she gets pregnant. Which, by the way, it may indicate that they actually had relations multiple times until it sounds like Vataharlo, that was the intent, but that's a very strange thing and just something in Chorma Machshava. In any case, he goes off, he goes back, and he then sends his friend, Re'ehu Adulami, Chira, to go find her and pay her up. And then he says something very strange, and this is what I'd like you to focus your attention on. Take a look at Pasuk Chaf. Verse 20. Yuda doesn't go himself, he sends it to the friend. Which, by the way, means that his dalliance with this girl is not a secret. It's not as if it's some, you know, thing he has to hide, what happens in Petach Inayim stays in Petach Inayim. He's telling his ally, you know, I had relations with this girl and I owe her a thing, and go here, take it, and pay her up. There's nothing secretive about it. Yeah, but I'm saying he's not at all embarrassed or secretive about the fact that now that his wife died, that he's going off to meet with a Kadesha. So he sends him to go get the pledge back and pay the thing. Where is this Kadesha in Einam? Einam is the name of a town in Yehuda. Where is this Kadesha? There never was one here. It's like something out of a Twilight Zone. You go there, there's a prostitute waiting for you, you have your way with her, you come back, and then suddenly the building's gone, the cash register is gone, the credit card machine is all gone, everything's gone. So we got a 24. All right? Vayashul Yehuda v'yomer lo matzatiha. So he comes back and he says, I couldn't find her. V'gam atshem makom amru lo itel v'zekadeshah. Which means now it's really public. Hi, listen, where's the kadeshah? We owe her some money. All right? What does Yehuda say? And this is really a remarkable statement. Go get it. Go find her. Why? We will be disgraced. What's a disgrace? You're willing to admit publicly that with the loss of your wife, you're now looking for a one-night stand, essentially. That's fine. But not paying her up, that's going to be the disgrace. Now, he doesn't put the focus on get the ID back. That will be the shame. He puts the focus on, I want to make sure she gets properly paid. That will be the shame. Very bizarre. Now, what happens? No success. 3 months later, a report comes from Tamar's parents' house. She's showing. What does that mean? If she's showing, that means she had relations with somebody. Who are the options here? Heir, dead. Onan, dead. Shelah, still and gone. Which means who'd she have relations with? Somebody on the outside. What's Yehuda's response? Burn her. She's part of the family. She had relations outside of the family. She has to die. So she, and this is the fantastic statement about Tamar, Mutav, better to let yourself be burned alive. We don't mean that literally. But better to suffer that kind of death than to embarrass somebody else. She doesn't say to Yehuda, you're the man. Ataish, which is descendant, we'll hear something like that later. Instead she says, take a look at these, see if you recognize who they are, whose they are. And Yehuda then says, Sadkami Meni, she is more innocent than I am. I'm more guilty here. And so and what's his guilt? His guilt is because I held Shelah up as an illusion. Right? And so then what happens? Now if she's brought back into the family, 6 months later, we assume, you know, X months later, she gives birth, it's twins. Famously, Zerach comes out, they put a band on him, and boom, Peretz shoots out at first, and Peretz becomes the Peretz, the one who bursts through, and he becomes the Bechor, and of course from there we get Nachshon, and we get Boaz, and we get David, and we get Shlomo, and we get Mashiach. Right? That's the story.
Gets punished for doing what he did.
Yes.
Killed. But Yehuda, who did so much wrong,
doesn't.
So much wrong by whose standards?
What's that?
So much wrong by whose standards?
The Torah, I guess.
Which is what? What was the wrong?
He slept with somebody.
He had a one night stand with a harlot.
He refused to give his son the one that's the illusion.
Right.
So these are all wrong things.
Okay, good. So let's look at them. Having a dalliance with a harlot, certainly before Matan Torah, no prohibition whatsoever.
His daughter.
No prohibition. Right?
His daughter-in-law.
But he doesn't know that. He's going, in other words, and the whole time he's totally open about it. He sends his friend to go find her and send a goat. He's not hiding anything because there's nothing to be embarrassed about. Right? In other words, the norms of the society then are that this is nothing embarrassing. He's got nothing to be embarrassed about. He does admit that he made a mistake. And what was the mistake? The mistake was holding Shelah up as this future husband and just keep saying, well, next week, you know.
Do we know how long the time period is?
No clue. One thing to point out that's critical also about this is that even though the story is presented after the sale of Yosef, it almost assuredly took place before, or at least started before. And the reason is that what's the longest amount of time that could exist from the sale of Yosef until the brothers come down to Egypt? The most amount of time is 22 years. 22 years. It couldn't be more. Couldn't be more. Could be less. Could be that Yosef wasn't sold till he was 20. Because we meet him at 17. We don't know what happens right away. But we know that he's 17 when we first meet him before the sale. We know he's 39 when they were united. So the max you have is 22 years. Now, in 22 years, you've got Yehuda getting married, having Er and Onan, and then years later, Shelah, there's a gap. Er is old enough to get married. Onan is old enough to do Yibum. Shelah then grows up enough to now fill in that gap. And at that point, Tamar goes off. Tamar then gets pregnant with Yehuda, and the grandchildren go down to Egypt. Fit that into 22 years. Good luck. Which is why the Ibn Ezra and the Rabag and others say that this entire event actually started before Mechirat Yosef. There's others who do it differently. Kasuto changes it on the back end. We talked about that once years ago. But this whole story, why do I need it? What do I need it for? I have these characters who come and go. Er, Onan, Shelah, I don't care about them. Peretz and the only one I really care about, Peretz and Zerah, the only ones I really care about, they play a role later on in Jewish history as ancestors. Of in the Yehuda tribe, very important, but I don't need a story to find out about them. I didn't hear how Yachleel was born. There's a name in Naphtali, Yachleel, so what? I mean, I don't need to hear this whole story. What's it for? So I think that the critical scene in the family is the scene that's at the top page two. The brothers all gather around Yaakov's bed. Yaakov is dying. And he then gives what the text later refers to as a bracha. Some of it's a little bit more of a mishaberach than a bracha. But he is evidently assigning them tasks or positions and probably land within the family. Who does he start with? He starts with Reuven. Why does he start with Reuven? So we all assume he's starting with Reuven because he's going to go in birth order, but the problem is it doesn't happen. After Yehuda, the birth order is gone. I think you're right, it's birth order, but it's only birth order for the first four for the following reason. The real question that's sitting here at Yaakov's deathbed, along with all the side questions, such as who's going to get what piece of land? Zvulun's going to be by the sea. Doesn't work that way exactly, but by the sea. Yehuda's going to get vineyards, etc. Besides that, the real critical question is, who's going to be in charge of the family? I mean, this family is big. This family is wealthy. This family is a clan. It's not just a little nuclear family. It's a family of hundreds of members, including slaves and all that. Because remember, we count 70. We only count the bloodline. We don't count the wives. Right? And then we're not counting slaves. And now it's a generation later, or a few years later, so the family's grown. We got a lot of people here. Who's going to be in charge? And we're not yet ready, not by a long shot, to say, well, Reuven, you got your family, you be in charge of them. We're still operating with a single family. By the time we meet Bnei Yisrael again, when Moshe's about to take them out of Mitzrayim, then we got 12 families. And then the trick is how to unite them temporarily. But right now, it's one family. Who's going to be in charge? So you got to start at the top. Reuven theoretically should be in charge. Reuven is not going to be in charge. Why not? Reuven b'choriata. Sounds promising. Kochi v'reshitoni. My first strength. Sounds like an automatic. Yeter seit v'yeter az. A lot of strength, but pachas kamayim al totar. And those four words kill him. You were hasty as running water, and therefore you did not gain the advantage. What does that mean? So let's roll back to Reuven's big blunder, although he had a few. He had a big blunder. What was his big blunder? I'm going to talk about this for a minute, because critical in understanding this passage.
Bilhah.
His big blunder is Bilhah. Say that a few times. Right? It's Bilhah. What happened with Bilhah? And when? Rachel had just died. What does Reuven do? What does Reuven do? So what does the text say he did? He slept with Bilhah Pilega Shaviv. Listen to the word, Pilega Shaviv. What do Chazal say in most of the Midrashim, not all, that he did? He rearranged the beds. I'll tell you a secret. They're the same thing. Because it's not about sex, it's about power. It goes back to what we talked about Cham years ago. It's not about sex, it's about power. What was Reuven trying to do? He's trying to do two things. He's trying to do one thing, which is exactly what Avshalom does, exactly what Adoniyahu tries to do, and perhaps what Cham tried to do, which is to take over the family because the father is already an AK, and I'm going to step in and I'm going to demonstrate taking over the family by taking his wife. That's the first Svara. But I think there's something deeper going on. Right now, what's the makeup of the family? At this point, when Rachel dies, what's the makeup of the family? There's 12 sons. Dina is going to be forgotten. There's 12 sons. What's the power structure of those 12 sons? It's 6 sons of Leah. It's 1 son and a little baby of Rachel. And it's 4 slave boys. We don't remember that. Because we're accustomed to stained glass windows and a choshen and all that with 12 names on it. But that's not what exists here. What does Yaakov want to do in order to give Yosef and Binyamin a leg up in the family? He wants to destroy the hegemony of Bnei Leah, or at least equalize it. How will he do that? By turning Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher into full sons. How do you do that? Marry their moms. So what does Yaakov do with Bilhah? He wants to take her as a wife. What does Reuven do first? He gets in the way of that. I don't care if he gets in the way by sleeping with her or by moving the bed. It's all the same. He's trying to stop that shift of power. And therefore the text says, Vayishkav Bilhah Pilega Shaviv. But when we first meet Yosef, we find out what worked. When we first meet Yosef, being in this week's parsha, what do we hear? Which means Yaakov was successful in elevating them to be full wives, which means now what's the power structure? 6 and 6. There's an equilibrium, which is why Yosef's hanging out with them. Yosef needs them. You think they need Yosef. Yosef needs them so that he's not in this small minority. But I want to go back to Reuven. Reuven is the one who tried to manipulate the power structure of the family on his own. And by the way, everything Reuven does is always on his own and always fails. He goes up to his father and says, you could take my 2 sons as a pledge and da-da-da. Oh, I got an idea. Let's just throw Yosef in the pit. I'll save him. That doesn't work either. Reuven's a Nebuch here. That's the way he's presented. But he always operates on his own. What does Yaakov say to him? You're out. Okay. Now I'm going to ask you the grand question because this really brings us to Yehuda. What is Abraham's job? And by the way, anytime you ask a question about Jewish history, about certainly about Bereshit, about Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar, anytime you've got to ask this question, what is Abraham's job? Because Abraham's job is our job. What is Abraham's job?
One God.
That's not a job. That's a declaration.
I mean, he brought monotheism to the world.
His job is to teach everybody about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's his job. His job is to be makariv everybody. Now, you can't be makariv everybody. There are some people who are beyond it. That's why there's war. That's why there's people you can't be with. So what does Avraham do? Please take a look at source 3. Hashem tells Avraham, you come to the land, and what's going to be the result of this great blessing? V'nivrchu v'cha kol mishpachot adama. All families of the earth will be blessed through you. That's not going to happen by you sitting in a little igloo by yourself. It's going to happen with you interacting with them. What kind of interaction? So it's an interesting thing. Take a look after when Avraham and Lot come back from Egypt, and they're wealthy. We talked about this from a different perspective a few weeks ago. Avraham and Lot come back from Egypt. They're both wealthy. What happens? There's a fight between the shepherds. And there's a strange line thrown in. V'haknani v'aprizi az yoshev ba'aretz. Who cares? Didn't I know they were there? So some of the Rishonim explain that the problem here is that here Avraham and Lot are supposed to, or at least Avraham is supposed to be teaching everybody the right way to live. And here you've got these people around who he's supposed to be influencing. In the meantime, how is he and his nephew getting along? Pretty terrible. So that explains why Avraham says we have to separate. In other words, why does Avraham move to separate? Because he says, I can't fulfill my mission, calls mom, that everybody sees that in my own family I got to fight. This is defining how Avraham looks at the others. He doesn't say, I don't care what they think. Ah, they're going, who cares? That's not what he says. And then where does he move to? He doesn't move to Hebron. Where does he move to? Elonei Mamre. Mamre is a man. Mamre is a person. And who is he? He's somebody that Avraham makes a breed with. Take a look in source 5. Where is Avraham living? Who shochein be'elonei Mamre ha'emori achi ashko v'achi aner v'heim balei v'rit Avraham. What do we find out about Avraham? What is Avraham doing in the land? He's making alliances with people. Real alliances. Not fake alliances. Not tactical steps. But real alliances with people, and he is loyal to the alliance, because later on in that story, when the king of Sodom offers him the goods, what does he say? I'm not taking anything. But Anerish, Kolam, Amre, they deserve their part. He speaks up for his treaty partners. He's loyal to a fault to them. And we see this later on. By the way, Avimelech. Avimelech comes to meet Avraham. What does Avimelech want? Avimelech wants to make a breach, because what does he say? We see God is with you. What do the people of Hebron say to Avraham when he wants to buy a kever? What's the first thing they say? Nesi Elohim atah b'tochenu. You're a lordly man among us. What does that mean? You're not somebody who sits way off there. You interact with us in a way that's inspirational. You teach us. Take any cave. So now I want to buy. An interesting thing about the difference, and this is painful for me personally, but an interesting difference between Avraham and Yitzchak. I heard last Sunday night at our little farewell dinner in Papagayo, we're talking about some of the chronology problems in Bereshit, and somebody mentioned that if you take a look at source 9, when Hashem speaks to Yitzchak, he says, it seems that Avram's already dead at this point. Why? Because he blesses Yitzchak, I'm going to bless you, Ekev Asher Shama Avraham Bekoli. Why am I blessing you? Because Avraham obeyed me. And the point was that Hashem never says that about living people. I was busy running to my car, so I didn't have a chance to answer. But it's not true, because take a look at Pasuk 8 from the Akedah. What does Hashem say to Avraham at the Akedah? V'arecha v'arecha chavarabar be'zaracha why ekev asher? Shamata v'koli. Because you listen to my voice. Look at the difference. Why is Yitzchak blessed? And again, I said it's personally painful. Why is Yitzchak blessed?
No, but it's different.
Yeah.
In the pasuk above, he's speaking directly in the second person Avraham. In the pasuk below, he's speaking about Avraham.
Right, but why doesn't he say Ekev Asher Shamata V'Koli to Yitzchak? Why doesn't Yitzchak get that?
And Yitzchak is still alive when Yaakov has a Sulam
dream. Right.
And he and Avraham
are both mentioned.
They're both
right.
Mentioned.
So it's certainly true that God does mention people who are alive. Right.
But I think Yitzchak's the only one.
Well, could be, but here Avraham, God says to him, Ekev Asher Shamata V'Koli, to Avraham while he's alive. So, it's hard to understand, but I think the difference is that Yitzchak's way is not the ultimate way, and Avraham's is. What's Yitzchak's way? How does Yitzchak interact with everybody in Canaan? He either avoids them or gets in fights with them. Again, it's difficult to say, but look at the reality. Yitzchak goes to Pleshet and gets in fight after fight with the locals. I mean, the locals were terrible, but he has a fight after fight with them. When he has his interaction with Avimelech, Avimelech drives him out. Atzamta lanu miod, you're too big for us. Whereas when Avram's with Avimelech, what does Avimelech say? Stay in our land, please. Or Yitzchak spends his life in isolation. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. So Yitzchak recognizes this. What does Yitzchak say to Yaakov when he sends him off? He says, V'itenachat Birkat Avraham. What's Birkat Avraham? What does that mean? I think it means that I'm telling you, you need to follow not my derech, but the derech of Saba. You, the way you need to interact with people here is the way that Avraham did. How did Avraham interact with the locals? He made britot. He made alliances. He made relationships with them. He interacted with them. Okay, now let's roll ahead and take a look at what happens later on. Let's see what happens later on with the sons. Yaakov, an interesting comment. I didn't have room for this on the page. When Yaakov comes back from Lavan, there's a very strange passage. It says, Yaakov and Lavan are going to make a brit, and they want to make a pile of rocks. And Yaakov says, Le'echav liktu avanim. Who are Echav? What does the word Ach mean in Tanakh? Ach means not only brother or male family relative, like with Avram and Lot, it also means treaty partner, like Hiram says to Shlomo, Achi. Like we say today, bro. But there it's a formal thing, it's a treaty partner. Yaakov's got treaties with people. He's got britot with people. He's not sitting there on his own, and he's not against everybody. So when Yaakov comes to Shechem, and this is what I want to bring out, what is Shimon and Levi's modus operandi for the locals? What do? You deceive them. You lie to them. You trick them. And then when you got them down, you murder them. What is Yaakov's reaction? None of us like it. We really don't like Yaakov's reaction. Because Yaakov's reaction looks wimpy. Yaakov's reaction to the murder looks like it's self-serving, but it's not moralistic. Because he doesn't say, you were wrong, it's terrible, you're innocent people. What does he say? We're gonna get wiped out. But Yaakov's saying something much deeper. Achartem moti. You have made me rotten in the eyes of the people here. They're going to attack me because now we've made ourselves the outsider, we've made ourselves the enemy here, instead of being the ones who are integrated into the society. And by being integrated, influencing them and bringing them up. What does Yaakov do when he first gets to Shechem? He buys land, he settles in, he's got a decent relationship with them, separate but decent. Shimon and Levi take a whole different tack. So now let's go to the end of the road. Yaakov's on his deathbed, and he's got to determine who's going to take care of the family, who's going to be in charge of the family. Reuven, you always worked on your own, and everything you did on your own failed. And you tried to manipulate the situation through power. You're out. Shimon and Levi, you have the entire wrong derech. You think that the way to interact with the locals is to murder them and to deal with them dishonestly? Absolutely not. Look very carefully at the bracha to Yehuda in passage 2. Yehuda, ata yoducha achecha yadcha ba'orif oivecha. My entire life, I thought that the word achecha here meant your siblings. I don't think it means that. Yehuda, ata yoducha achecha means you've got lots of treaty partners. You've got lots of friends. You've got lots of people around you who acknowledge you, who recognize you. And as a result of that, you're able to have your hand on the neck of the enemies. Not everybody's an enemy. They're not all enemies. Some are enemies, and you've got to identify them. In the meantime, you've got to make britot with everybody else, and then you can deal with the enemies. You know why you're going to be successful in defeating your enemies, Yehuda? Because you have lots of friends. You know why you're going to be able to isolate the evil? Because you've identified the good in others and you've connected with it. That's what makes you the proper king. And you look in David's career, because David, of course, is Yehuda. And David makes betot with others, including others who are not Jewish. He has them as part of his entourage. And he's successful with it. Yaakov is establishing a mode of leadership in which the derech of Avraham to be a model of honesty, of integrity, of forthrightness, of uprightness, and to do it in a way that is inclusive as much as possible of kol mishpachot ha'adama, and where necessary is adversarial. Now, we look back at our story on page 1. And what theme comes through underneath the text? Yehuda leaves his brothers, goes settled in Timnah. Goes settle in Adullam. He has a friend. And this friend is a trusted friend who is not Jewish. Not a member of the family. Nobody's Jewish, but not a member of the family. He's Chirarei Adullami. He marries a local girl. He has kids and he deals with them honestly. And the one dishonesty that he acts on, he pays for it, he recognizes it. And that's where Malchut comes from. That's where the monarchy comes from, and ultimately that's where Mashiach is going to come from. Somebody who will know and understand how to include all Mishpachot Adama who are able to be included, and therefore isolate and identify those hopefully few who really are beyond that salvation and have to be with Yehuda's hand on their neck.